Good morning. And this is Carol Stackler and Richard Fagan in the studio this morning with This Strange and Wonderful World. For those of you who've been listening, we're spending January and February in the Antarctic. Our first program described the geography and the ice and the habitat and many other things, actually, of Antarctic. And Richard Fagan has actually visited Antarctic, I believe, 5 times as a host, kind of the historian, I would say, on a tour of people who were interested in coming and learning about and actually visually seeing the Antarctic. Richard lives on Lopez Island. He's a retired professor from Stanford, where he his areas of expertise were, he started in journalism and political science, and now here he is in Antarctica. So today I'm gonna let Richard take over now, and we're gonna continue with our early explorer travels. So Richard, welcome again.
Thank you very much. Well, it's fitting that we're in Antarctica after some of the weather we had in December and January. It's not Antarctica, but for Lopez, it was pretty good. A little kiss of winter. Now, last time I spoke about Sir Robert Scott, who is certainly one of the two or three best known of all the Antarctic early explorers, and certainly the other person in the same situation, which is to say extremely well known, very famous really, increasingly so almost, is Sir Ernest Shackleton. And I'm going to introduce Shackleton rather toward the end of the story by reading something which is basically the log of, part of the log of the open boat voyage which climaxed his most famous trip to Antarctica. And this was written by Captain Frank Worsley, who accompanied Shackleton on an open boat voyage, which we'll talk about later. Probably one of the two or three most famous open boat voyages in the history of seafaring, rivaled really perhaps only by Captain Bligh's long, long open boat voyage in the Pacific after the mutiny on the Bounty. So here's Worsley talking about the Southern Ocean. Offspring of the westerly gales, the great unceasing westerly swell of the Southern Ocean rolls almost unchecked around the end of the world in the roaring 40s and the stormy 50s. The highest, broadest, and longest swells in the world. They race on their encircling course until they reach their birthplace again, and so, reinforcing themselves, sweep forward in fierce and haughty majesty. That's back when sea captains were also poets. And as I say, we'll talk about that open boat voyage later on. So let's get an introduction to Mr. Shackleton. He was born in 1874 on February 15th. In fact, he was Anglo-Irish, and he was trained as a merchant navy officer, not as a regular naval officer. And he went to sea at 16. He went south for the first time, south being to Antarctica, with Robert Scott on the Discovery in 1901. That was a trip that lasted until 1903. And he and Scott and Dr. Wilson, whom we met last time we talked about Scott, Dr. Bill Wilson, they went 82 degrees south, in other words, to within 8 degrees of the South Pole. At that time, it was a record. Now, you have to remember, this is before Amundsen actually got to the pole. It was in 1902. Shackleton got sick, probably from scurvy, because it was very hard to keep up your vitamin C levels with the diet that they had, and he was sent home. He was sent home on one of the relief ships. This was viewed as something of a disgrace. Now, he vowed that he was going to get to the pole, And so in 1907, he led his own South Pole expedition on a ship called the Nimrod. In October 1908, this is still a couple of years before Amundsen got to the pole, he and three companions got to 88 degrees south. It was a record, a very substantial record, way over the 82 degrees that they had done before, barely 100 miles from the pole, but they were starving. And Shackleton said, "We're not going to get back. We can get to the pole, but if we get to the pole, we're dead men." So he returned before getting to the pole. And when he got home, he said to his wife, "Better a live donkey than a dead lion," right? He was made commander of the Royal Victorian Order and thus became, at that point, in recognition of getting so close to the pole, he became Sir Ernest Shackleton. Now, the next time he got to Antarctica was not until 1914. And if you remember your chronology, both Amundsen and Scott had already gotten to the pole at that time. Amundsen returning successfully, first there, returned alive and well, and Scott and his companions dying on the return trip. So what was left? The pole had already been conquered. And logically, at least in the spirit of the times, the next great goal was to cross the continent. In other words, go from one side up to the pole, and then from the pole back down and come out the other side. So, in 1914, after much planning, much money raising, Shackleton launched what was known as the Imperial Trans-Antarctic Expedition. Now, the plan was as follows. That Shackleton would come in from the, I'll call it the South American side, because the jumping off point is really either the Falkland Islands or Argentina or Chile. Come in from that side, get to the pole, and then coming up from the New Zealand side, there would be a second expedition, and they would lay supply depots between the coast on the New Zealand side and the pole. Then they would withdraw, and Shackleton, on his way down, out the other side, would use those supply depots in order to get the sustenance and the equipment and the supplies they needed to get across. Now, Shackleton sailed from the Falkland Islands toward Antarctica, on a ship called the Endurance. He sailed on August 8th, 1914. This is the guns of August. The First World War was just beginning. By January 18th, which is to say 5 months later, they were frozen in the ice. In other words, at the height of the southern summer, January, remember the seasons are reversed, they had become trapped in the ice. They could not escape from the ice. And the ice drifts, of course, because there are sea currents and there are winds, and the Endurance drifted north with the ice until on October 24th, as you can see, 9 months later, they've been in the ship for 9 months, trapped in the ice, drifting, absolutely unable to control where they're going or how fast they're going, the hull began to break up. So the hull had lasted trapped in the ice, but the ice pressure after 9 months was such that basically the Endurance was being squeezed to death. And believe it or not, and I may talk a little bit about this next time, there is actually motion picture film, filmed by Shackleton's photographer, a man by the name of Hurley, of the ship breaking up. It's a shame we don't have television, because this motion picture footage, old motion picture footage taken on the spot at the time of the ship breaking up, obviously it's silent film, is among the most dramatic thing that you'll ever see from that time. But anyway,
Do you actually have that film?
I actually do have that film, yes.
Well,
it's quite short, as you might imagine.
Oh, yes, I personally would love to see that. Sometimes this is astonishing, because I've had this question the whole time: how do those ships survive? And they don't always.
No, and okay. Theirs wasn't the only one to be crushed. They were wooden ships, of course.
Yeah.
Heavily reinforced by iron. This ship, the Endurance, its very name suggests that it was made to endure.
Right.
Was actually quite well prepared for the ice, but when the ice pressure builds up, it can crush almost anything.
Right.
And the ship was crushed. they abandoned ship and they set up camp on the ice, because of course if the ice was strong enough and solid enough to crush the ship, you could also of course walk on it. So now they have no ship and they're on the ice. They succeeded in rescuing 3 small boats from the ship, some of the supplies, not all of the supplies, and there were 28 men who were on the ship, now camped on the ice, and they had 18 reindeer skin sleeping bags for the 28 men. So that it was very clear they were short of many things, in it, including appropriate sleeping bags to live with. By the way, Hurley, the photographer that I mentioned before, had a great many wonderful, wonderful still photographs as well. Now, still photographs, as you probably know, at that time were made on glass plates. These still photographs were deep in the ship's hold when she began to break up, and they were abandoned. Hurley asked permission from Shackleton to go back aboard and get his treasured photographs. And he dove into the freezing water in the hold, rescued the photographs, and so we have also a magnificent still photographic record of the ship on the ice, the camps on the ice, and in fact, basically everything almost everything having to do with this great voyage.
So, do we have any idea about what the temperature would have been?
Yeah, the temperature would have been just below freezing. Because this ice that we're talking about is frozen seawater. This isn't glacial ice that's come off the continent. It's frozen seawater, and it will freeze at about 28 degrees. So it was 28 degrees or less, something like that.
And what about the temperature on the ice for the people that were camped there? What was
Of course, it varied, but notice that by the time they abandoned the ship, October, they have gone through the winter, and it's right now spring down there. So the temperature's right rising. Now, they camped on the ice next to the ship, which was being crushed and evidently making unbelievable noises, for 4 weeks before the ship actually sank. And at that point, Shackleton said to his men, "Ship and stores have gone, so now we'll go home." Now, this, of course, is classic Shackleton. They're on the ice. They have no ship. They're thousands of miles from any place. And the ship gets crushed, and he says, "Ship and stores have gone, so now we'll go home." So they made another ice camp, and they called it Patience Camp. They had a knack for naming things. And they spent almost 5 more months on that ice camp. Basically, they're still drifting, and they're drifting to the northwest, roughly, not very fast. So they have now been 9 months on the ship trapped in the ice, 5 more months in the camp on the ice, and the ice begins to break up around them. Now, when the ice breaks up, it's not really dependent on the weather and the temperature as much as it is on the winds and the currents. So winds and currents break up the ice, and they break it up so that on April 9th, 1916, they take to these lifeboats, the 3 lifeboats that they have with them, and they're at sea in open water. Not completely open water, but enough so that they can sail and row these boats. And notice it's April 9th, spring in the northern hemisphere, fall, winter coming on in the southern hemisphere. They spend 5 harrowing days at sea, and they finally land at a small, rocky, rather inhospitable island called Elephant Island. I've been to Elephant Island twice, and it's not the place you'd choose to spend your vacation. It's a mean little spit of rock with a penguin colony, fortunately, and also some seals, very fortunate, because that's a source of food and fuel. But it's just right out there in the middle of the Southern Ocean, buffeted by storms,
etc. About how big is it?
You know, I'm not sure, but it's certainly probably, I would say, a fraction of Decatur Island.
Okay, sure. You know,
we're talking maybe a couple of miles long, and in a kind of hook or a scimitar shape. There's only one place you can really land on it. It's a rocky beach. And as I say, been past it on more than one occasion when we couldn't land at all in these big rubber Zodiacs that we use. It was just too rough. The surf was too rough. Anyway, they managed to get there. They get ashore. Now, they're stuck in Elephant Island. Nobody knows they're there. Nobody knows if they're alive. And the question is, what are they going to do? He's promised to get them home. There's the 28 men, remember. And Shackleton decides that he'll take the largest of the lifeboats, which was named the James Caird. James Caird was a benefactor of the voyage, and the boats were named after these benefactors, people who gave money for the voyage. They'll take the James Caird, and they will attempt to sail to the nearest inhabited land. I'll speak about that in a minute. But I want you to get some idea of what the James Caird looked like, still looks like. 22 feet long. For those of you, for instance, who know the boat that was built in Steve Brower's shop and taken up to Alaska by his son and friends, a boat called the Tern, built here on Lopez Island, the James Caird was roughly the same size as the Tern. In other words, she was 22 feet long with about a 7-foot beam, and she was rigged with a simple mast and a sail and designed to be rowed and sailed for short distances, of course, in fairly calm water. Now, the nearest land that Shackleton knew was inhabited and where they could perhaps mount a rescue party is South Georgia Island. And if you take a look at the map of the Southern Ocean, South Georgia Island is actually part of the Falklands group, but it's way to the east of the Falklands group. And so from Elephant Island on a straight line to South Georgia Island, it's 800 miles. So what he was facing was an 800-mile voyage in an open boat.
Now, and did he know where he was headed?
Well, he had been to South Georgia Island, and he knew where he wanted to go.
Okay.
And I'll speak a little later about how they navigated there. So it was clear in his own mind what the voyage was. There were no surprises there. These were waters that they and other people knew. The question was, in a 22-foot boat with winter coming on, can you make that 800-mile voyage? Now, the reason to head to South Georgia Island, well, there are two reasons. First of all, because the prevailing currents and winds, which come from the west and go to the east, would help them on their voyage. They could not hope to sail and row against the prevailing wind. So they couldn't go to the west. They had to go to the east. The other thing is that by this time, South Georgia Island was the center of whaling activity in the Southern Oceans. Scots, Norwegians, and a few other nations were present there, and they were harvesting the great whales in the Southern Ocean, the great blue whale, the fin whale, and they were using small steam-powered catchers to harpoon these whales. So this was state-of-the-art modern industrial whaling, given the fact that we're at the time of the First World War, of course, and that state-of-the-art industrial whaling necessitated a very large infrastructure on land. Everything from boat building shops that could build small metal vessels to all the rendering plants, all the housing, all the food. So South Georgia Island, although very, very isolated, was nevertheless a place where there was a great deal of, in quotation marks, civilization. So Shackleton knew, that if they could get there, they'd be okay. They weren't just going to some little outpost. This was the major inhabited place in the whole Southern Ocean. So as a destination, it made sense both in navigational terms, but it also made sense in terms of the civilization and the help that they could get there. Now, I read at the beginning of this the words of Captain Frank Worsley, who was the navigator in this boat version. He was actually the captain of the Endurance. And what Shackleton did is that he left 22 men on Elephant Island, where they had taken the two boats, the smaller boats that remained, they had turned them upside down, and they had built a shelter where the 22 men could live, somewhat protected from the elements, and of course depending on the seal meat and the penguin meat for food and fuel. Before they left Elephant Island on this voyage, it was Shackleton and five companions who set out. They had the James Caird rebuilt, and rebuilt just by taking planks off the other boats, things like that, in order to raise her freeboard, because they knew that they would be going into seas that would break completely over the boat. And she was originally an open boat, and if she had been left completely an open boat, she would have swamped in the first great sea. So they built her up and decked her over to the extent that they could, just leaving a small open space. And in fact, I had the privilege of actually seeing the James Caird, because the James Caird, this is getting a little ahead of the story, it survived. The James Caird survived. She was taken back to England, and I don't know, it must have been 7-8 years ago, something like that. She was brought to New York for an exhibit at the American Museum of Natural History. And I may talk a little bit about that exhibit later, but the James Caird was there. And when you take a look at it and you think of the voyage they took in it, it just boggles the mind. How did these guys do it? Anyway, on with the voyage. The major problem, in addition to keeping the six men alive on the small boat and navigating because if they miss South Georgia, they're dead, because then they're in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and next stop, Africa. So they couldn't possibly have survived that. The most amazing part of this voyage is really the navigational feat. And I'm going to read a little bit from, again, this book published by Frank Worsley, remember, who was the captain of the Endurance and the navigator on the James Caird. This is a book which is called Shackleton's Open Boat Voyage. And here's Worsley. "Stormy, snowy weather, rolling, pitching, and tumbling. We labored before the roaring green-gray seas that towered over us, topped with hissing white combers that, alas, always caught us. Bruised and soaked, with never a long enough interval for our bodies to warm our streaming clothes, in zero weather we now fully gauged the misery and discomfort of our adventure. So we held our way, in those valleys and on those ridges alternately, first half becalmed, a hill of water ahead, another astern. The following hill lifts us. The boat slides with increasing speed down the ever-steepening slope till, with a sudden upward swoop, the sea boiling white around us and over us, we're on the summit with a commanding view of a panorama of dark gray and indigo blue rollers, topped and broken with white horses. The crest passing leaves the boat apparently stationary, gravity now holding her back till the next hollow reaches us, and so on ad nauseum."
Why in the world did they not die of hypothermia?
Well, I think because they were very, very tough guys.
Wow.
Yeah. Listen to this one. This is about the ice. This is Worsley again. May Day. So it's the 1st of May. Remember, we're in the southern seasons. "The ice on the boat got so thick and heavy that she was riding deep and had a tendency to capsize. Something had to be done, and quickly. So we took it in turns to crawl out with an axe and chop off the ice. What a job! The boat leaped and kicked like a mad mule. She was covered 15 inches deep in a casing of ice like a turtleback, with slush all over where the last sea was freezing. First you chopped a handhold, then a kneehold, and then chopped off ice hastily, but carefully, with an occasional sea washing over you. After 4 or 5 minutes, fed up or frostbitten, you slid back into the shelter, and the next man took up the work. It was a case of one hand for yourself and one for the king. For if a man had gone overboard then, it would have been goodbye."
Really, again, these voyages are very difficult to imagine.
It is difficult for us to imagine. And here, you asked about hyperthermia. Here's what happens when they try and get a little sleep on this boat. They were using reindeer sleeping bags, which was really the best insulating material available. And typically, when they used reindeer for various things, they would turn it inside out. So the fur wasn't on the outside. The fur was in the inside. The hide was on the outside. And here's what Worsley says about these bags. The reindeer bags were now so miserable to get into that when we'd finished our watch and it was time to turn in, we had serious doubts as to whether it was worthwhile. The smell of cured skin constantly soaked and slept in was appalling. First you undressed, that is, you took off your boots, and throwing back the flap of the bag, thrust your legs in hurriedly. It felt like getting between frozen rawhide, which it was. You kicked your feet violently together for 2 minutes to warm them, and the bag then slid into the waist. Again you kicked your feet and knocked your knees together, then, like a little hero, made a sudden brave plunge right inside. At first, while you knocked your feet together, it felt like an ice house, and then it began to thaw out, and you wished it hadn't. It smelled so, and the molting hairs got into eyes, mouth, and nose. So coughing, sneezing, and spluttering, you kicked your feet valiantly together till there was enough warmth in them to allow you to sleep for perhaps an hour. When you awoke, you kicked again till you fell asleep, and so on. After this gale, because he's describing here the end of a gale, the bags were in such a hopeless, sloppy, slimy mess and weighed so heavily that Sir Ernest had the worst two thrown overboard.
Oh, you know, my sons were really interested in curing animal skins. So I personally have the experience, I mean, in a very small scale, of smelling those skins in those buckets.
Well, of course.
And they're beyond... no language will describe that slimy, awful stuff. Yeah.
And, of course, they had two choices. They had slime or they had ice.
Yeah,
and, of course, the ice didn't smell like the slime did.
It's just amazing.
Now, here, I want to go back for a moment to this exhibit they had at the Museum of Natural History with the Caird. And one of the things they had was an interactive display. Now, I have used a sextant. I'm not very good with it, but at least I know what the idea is. And what they had at this display, it was really quite wonderful. They had the horizon was bouncing around, projected on the walls, bouncing around as if you were in the open boat. So when you looked out from the navigation station where there was a sextant, the horizon was bouncing around and going up and down and tilting one way and the other. And in taking a sight, I think many of you know this, the idea is you get the horizon, you get the sun, and you bring the sun down with the sextant optically till it touches the horizon. And then you read off the figures, the degrees that are on the sextant. And the trick, of course, is to make an accurate reading, which is hard to do when the horizon is bouncing around and when you're bouncing around and the sextant is bouncing around. So they had this thing set up on a small computer so that when you shot the sun with this sextant, it would do the calculations for you. Of course, they were doing the calculations, as arithmetic and a little bit of logarithm stuff. But the computer did it for you.
A computer? What? That's what you...
Well, the sextant was hooked to a computer.
Yeah, but so even the thinking about a computer at that time is...
No, but I'm saying in the exhibition at the Museum of Natural History.
Thank you very much. I got
it. So I shot the sun. I got what I hoped was the best reading I could. And the computer told me that I was 600 miles north of South Georgia Island. In other words, I would have soon been dead. It seems absolutely impossible to get accurate readings, but somehow Frank Worsley managed to navigate this boat in these conditions and this sea to exactly where they wanted to land on the south side of South Georgia Island. So they are there. And they're in terrible shape. And the south side of the island is not the inhabited side of the island. The inhabited side of the island is the north side. And it's quite a large island. It's dozens of miles long and thick at the middle, and there is a range of serious mountains that run down the spine of South Georgia. So now Shackleton and his companions, his five companions, are on the southern side of the island. They are safe, but they're not completely safe because they haven't made any human contact with yet. So the next task is they have to cross these mountains. And these mountains had never been crossed at this time. There was no path. There was no way of knowing what they were going to do. So he decides to cross, taking Worsley and one other, a seaman, with him to go to a whaling station at a place called Stromness on the north shore of the island. The gear they had, their mountaineering gear, was screws, ordinary screws, which had been screwed into the bottom of their boots, basically to act as crampons so they could get some traction. They had 50 feet of rope to rope together. They had a compass, and they had a bit of food. And they knew they had to cross fast, going, well, it's mainly dark at this time, but continuously. They couldn't stop. If they stopped, they were dead. They managed to cross in 36 hours, just not really knowing where they were going. They were just taking compass readings or knowing what was ahead, anything like that. So they went up thousands of feet, crossed the mountains. Those mountains were not crossed again until 1955. It's that difficult. And here's Worsley again on one of the really critical moments of this. They got to a crest, and when they looked down, they saw that from what they could see, because it was dark out, they could see that there was just a slope falling away. They didn't see any way to get down that. It was too precipitous. So Shackleton says to them, now I'm reading Worsley, "We'll try it. Each coiling our share of the rope beneath us for chafing gear, I straddled behind Sir Ernest, holding on to his shoulder. Crean, that's the third man, did the same to me, and so locked together, we let go. I was never more scared in my life than for the first 30 seconds. The speed was terrific. I think we all gasped at that hair-raising shoot into darkness. Crean had hard work to prevent the short-handled adze coming around and cutting us." They were using a carpenter's tool, as a brake on this, on their little improvised sled, really.
Their ice axe.
Right.
Yeah. Then
to our joy, the slope curved out, and we shot into a bank of soft snow. We estimated we had shot down a mile in 2 or 3 minutes and had lowered our elevation by 2,000 or 3,000 feet. So they had just plunged into the darkness with this minimal equipment, and somehow they had survived. I mean, one really has to believe in miracles, because there was time and time and time again in this story when they should have been dead.
Absolutely. And I mean, they're bigger than life.
Yeah.
I mean, they're bigger than my imagination. I mean, if someone made a movie of this, it would be considered science fiction.
Yeah, well, a movie has been made of it, and it's not nearly as good as the real event. It's better just to read about it in Worsley than see the movie. So they got down, and of course, they were just horrible looking, you know, completely shaved, scratched, sooted up, because they burned the blubber of the animals, of the seals and of the penguins, and it was extremely sooty, and so their faces were completely blackened, as were their hands. And the Norwegian who ran the whaling station at Stromness was, well, Shackleton and the two others were brought to him, and he said to Shackleton, whom he knew well, "Who are you?" And Shackleton said, "I'm Shackleton. Don't you recognize me?" And then the captain began to cry when he saw what was standing before him. So now they're on South Georgia. They're at the whaling station, and in one of these little whaling, they're not so little, they're 80 footers, these little steam launches, they go around to the southern shore, and they pick up the three men who've been left there, along with the Caird. That's why the Caird survives to this day, because he was picked up. And now the question is, how are they going to get the men off Elephant Island? Because he had left 22 men there. And for 4 months, he tried to get the men off Elephant Island. Remember, it is now really winter. Winter certainly coming on, and sea ice prevented the rescue. In other words, they could not get. They tried with various boats, but they couldn't get a boat into Elephant Island. They couldn't even get close. Then finally, on August 30th, with a little steam tug, which was actually a Chilean tug called the Yelcho, they managed to get to Elephant Island. All 22 of the men that they had left there are still alive. Some have had some toes and things amputated, but they're all alive. Every morning from the time, really 5 months ago, when Shackleton left, the man in charge, Frank Wild, had said to the men on Elephant Island, "Lash up and stow, boys, the boss may come today." And finally, 5 months later, the boss does come.
And wow.
All 22 are picked up, and all 28 are taken back to England. The First World War, of course, is going on, and a number of them immediately, as soon as they're well and healthy again, go into the service, and several of them were killed in that great murderous war. Now, Shackleton wanted to go back to Antarctica, and he developed yet another expedition and went back in 1921. But at the very, very beginning of that expedition, he died of a heart attack. And he died it was really on South Georgia Island when he died. And he had asked people that if something happened to him, because they had a history of heart problems, he asked that he be buried on South Georgia Island. And he is, and you can visit his grave there today. I had a quite amazing experience a number of years ago at that gravesite on Grytviken, because there was a woman traveling with us by the name of Mrs. Macklin Scott. And Mrs. Macklin had been married to this young surgeon who went with Shackleton and was left on Elephant Island. Young surgeon who was one of the 22 there. He was 22, 23 at the time. He was a surgeon in the Second World War, and he met a young nurse, considerably younger than he, during the Second World War, and he married her. And Macklin died, I'm not quite sure when, but, you know, in the 70s or something like that, maybe even a little earlier than that, because he was born in the 1890s. In any event, but the widow, who was a woman probably of that time, I would say maybe pressing 70 years old, survived. And we went with her to Elephant Island. She had never been to Antarctica. And she and our expedition leader, because it was one of the times you could not land on Elephant Island, took out one of the Zodiacs and cruised past the spit where her husband had spent those months waiting for and hoping that Shackleton would come back to rescue them. She's a little tiny woman, maybe max 5 feet. And there she was being supported in this bouncing Zodiac by our expedition leader. And, you know, people aboard the ship watching this were thinking, I mean, what a moment for her. And then later, back at Grytviken, at Shackleton's grave, it usually fell to me on these trips to propose a toast at Shackleton's grave. So with her by my side and my arm around her, I proposed a toast to Shackleton and the men who had served with him. And it was, for me, a very moving moment, you know, to be there with this little lady who had been married to one of the many heroes on the Shackleton expedition.
You know, Richard, as I hear these stories of these voyages, I also am moved just in the telling of the story. And there is something about the one for all and all for one aspect of these journeys, as these men really survive, not only for themselves, but for their comrade, their brother, that is very sacred. There's something deeply I mean, I, the language escapes me, but it's of these are sacred journeys of humans who are forged into a unit of that they do things that are not imaginable.
Well, you're absolutely right. And one of the things that's happened with what I call the cult of Shackleton is to try and draw lessons for leadership from what he was able to do. And in fact, there are people who lecture in business schools, of all places, about Shackleton and leadership and sacrifice and camaraderie and teamwork and hope in the face of adversity, et cetera, et cetera. So he has been elevated into that position, certainly.
And now, you know, the other thing that really struck me was the other man on Elephant Island who every morning said, you know, pack up your gear, the boss might come today for 5 months.
Right.
What, I mean, that is right. The kind of leadership you're talking about is what this country and this world is calling on today.
One of the most lasting tributes to Shackleton, and I'll really close with that, comes from a man by the name of Sir Raymond Priestley. It's actually a fairly famous name in British science. He lived from 1886 to 1974, a British geologist and an Antarctic explorer who accompanied Shackleton on the Nimrod in the 1907. Remember, that's the one where they got close but no cigar. And he said the following when asked about Shackleton, you know, what Shackleton meant. Because after all, Shackleton failed in everything that he set out to do in terms of his goal as an explorer, and succeeded in everything that he didn't set out to do in terms of leadership in the face of adversity. And this is what Priestley said about him, and I think it's a nice way to close. He said, "For scientific leadership, give me Scott. For swift and efficient travel, Amundsen. But when you're in a hopeless situation, when there seems to be no way out, get down on your knees and pray for Shackleton."
A lovely, appropriate ending to this incredible journey and these incredible men, and particularly these leaders.
Yeah.
I'll say goodbye for now, and Richard, we'll be back again in 2 weeks with another adventure.
The next adventure, in a way, is as extraordinary as the Shackleton adventure, and it's the journey in the middle of winter to try and get a live penguin egg. I mean, it seems like foolishness, but I'll explain next week what it's all about. And we'll meet some of the people that we've met before. And the name of the great book which came from this is called The Worst Journey in the World, In Search of an Egg. So we'll take that journey to the extent that we can take it from the comfort of Lopez Island 2 weeks from now.
Perfect title for this strange and wonderful world. And I await that journey. This is KLOI LP, Lopez Island, Washington, 102.9 FM. And we'll return you to Megasec.